I wanted to start out by just sharing with you a personal experience. My father went into the hospital about 5 or 6 months ago. He was having some pain, and they did a bunch of tests, and they couldn't figure it out, and you know what was going on, and they ended up opening him up and discovering that he had mesothelioma, which is a form of lung cancer of the lining of the lung caused by exposure to asbestos. And the normal time from diagnosis to death is about 6 months. And so they just closed him up and said there's nothing they can do and sent him home, which is where he is right now. It turns out that he was exposed to that asbestos when I was born. He was going to college. He wanted to be a professor of history. He was working in a camera shop and going to school. And when my mom got pregnant with me, he dropped out of school and went to work at a factory of a major corporation that we shall remain nameless for the moment, in a steel mill, essentially, in Grand Rapids, Michigan, handling hot steel. And, of course, the hot steel was being handled in giant rollers that were made out of asbestos, and the pipes were asbestos, and there was just, he was just working in a cloud of asbestos for about a year. What's interesting is, as I've looked into this situation, I've discovered increasingly that the companies that were making and selling asbestos back then, this was 1951, realized that it would cause cancer, that it would kill people. In fact, it was in the 1950s that the conclusive study, I mean, the final research was done indicating that asbestos specifically caused mesothelioma. They already knew it caused all kinds of other things and a number of unknown cancers. The question is, how is it that these corporations were able to, number one, cover up the fact that they knew this for decades, continue to expose workers all across the world to it? I mean, my dad's situation is by no means unique. It's a very common situation among people who are veterans of World War II. The asbestos from the pipes and the ships that carried troops, you know, overseas, the people who were working on the ships, building them, in the construction trades. How did they hide that? And why? You know, why would otherwise honorable institutions, most of the companies that were making products for the war, were not defense contractors before the fact. They were companies that made cars and made trucks and built roads and things like that and all sorts of stuff. You know, why would that go on? Why would that happen? And what I'd suggest is that we have really two problems here, and that's what I'm here to talk with you about. And they both have one core. The acting out of them has one core, but there are two problems. And one is a problem of values, or what we might call morality, but I'd say values is probably a more accurate phrase. And the other is one of structure, a structure that allows, not just allows this to happen, but almost pretty much set up a situation where it's inevitable that what happened to my father and has happened to other people. There's many cases. I don't mention my father's case in the book, but there's, you know, I do mention several others of similar situations, not with asbestos, but with cars that were built to you know, turn into firebombs and companies polluting rivers and whatnot. What's going on? Well, first of all, with regard to values, the basis of all human morality comes from the fact that we are limited lifespan biological organisms. We live, you know, our fourscore and X years, or, you know, 80, 90, 100 years, whatever it is that we're capable of, and then we die. And during the course of this period of life that we have, we're confronted with some very specific homeostatic needs. We need to breathe. If we're deprived of air for more than a few minutes at a time, we die. We need to drink. If we're deprived of fresh water for more than a few days, we'll die. We need to eat pure food, and if we don't get pure food, we will waste away, or if we get contaminated food, we'll develop diseases like cancers. We must have shelter and warmth. We have these basic homeostatic needs, these needs that have to do with, that are common to all living things. This is like the needs of life. On the other hand, we have the corporate structure, which was created in, the modern corporation was incarnated in 1600, in December of 1600, when Queen Elizabeth I chartered the East India Company in England. After she had made a goodly return on Sir Francis Drake's The Golden Hind, they made about a 5,000% return on that investment. It was an early corporation, but there was a lot of concern about the risks involved in traveling around the world and exploring, and what if the ship went down, and what if terrible things happened, or what if they triggered a war or whatever, and they didn't want there to be risks to the investors. So Queen Elizabeth created the first limited liability corporation, where the investors' liability was limited to the amount of money that they put up. And if the East India Company went in debt, the investors wouldn't be responsible for that debt. If it got sued, the investors wouldn't be in trouble for that. And really, the corporate form has not changed tremendously since 1600 when she created it. And the single value of that corporate form is to grow and generate a profit. But the point is that there is this single morality of growth associated with the corporate form. Now, within constraints, there's nothing wrong with that. That's an entirely appropriate thing. In our bodies, for example, we have components that just continuously grow. Our hair, for example, our fingernails, you know, they just generally just continually grow and grow and grow and grow. But there's a limit to that. It's only in certain places, and there's even a limit to how much it grows. In biological systems, however, when growth subsumes all the other values, when growth begins to subsume the ability to breathe, when it takes over the ability to consume, you know, nutrients, when it takes over the ability to circulate blood, we call that cancer. And so understanding that there is an analogy between biological and economic and political systems, it's entirely reasonable for us, and we've been thinking this way for several hundreds of years, you know, we, Western civilization, modern civilization, that there be some limits on an organism or an artificial entity whose single value is growth, that there be these things placed on it. We also have to acknowledge that in even the very worst of corporations in the world, that there are some very good and honorable people. I've met people who work for oil companies, who work for chemical companies, who work I've met people who work for asbestos companies. You know, they're going to work, they're raising their families, they're trying to do the best they can, they feel like they're trapped in a system over which they have no control. They're terrified at the loss of their job because they'll lose their health insurance or they'll lose their retirement. That this isn't a problem of bad people. Now, currently, certainly the present administration and many people within the corporate world would like us to think it is. You know, it's nice to point the finger at individuals. It's a great distraction. But this isn't really the issue. It's simply a distraction. Yeah, there's bad people out there doing bad things. But that's really a completely separate issue. What we have here really is these two conflicting sets of values, that is, the human values that we need to live and eat and breathe, and yet our air is being polluted, our water is being devastated to the point that even, you know, our fish are dying in our rivers, our food is being polluted to the point where one in three of us will get cancer in our lifetimes. How did that value get subverted? Where did we lose track of that one? And then we've got, you know, this value, this corporate value of growth and profit, just growth and profit, growth and profit, growth and profit. Out of this, now, we have a structural problem. Okay, there's the value problem, and then secondarily, there's this structural problem. Corporations, for example, have asserted that under the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights, which guarantees free speech, that they not only have the right, because they have the right of free speech, they not only have the right to talk to politicians, they have the right to give money to politicians and influence the political process, even though they can't vote. They are not citizens. They love to talk about corporate citizenship, but there ain't no such thing. Corporations cannot vote. They're not citizens. And in fact, we have a lot of corporations in the United States who are doing business who've reincorporated in Bermuda, and they continue to talk about their marvelous corporate citizenship. But it's a trick. Anyhow, and now there's even a case going before the California Supreme Court soon, where one of the largest corporations in America, headquartered up in this part of the world, is asserting that in their advertising, in which they were claiming that they were not exploiting people in the third world and sweatshop labor and all this stuff, and they ran a series of ads, you know, claiming that they were good corporate citizens. Well, they got outed by a consumer group, and it turned out that they'd lied in their ads. And they have now admitted that they lied in their ads, but what they're going to court is to say, under the First Amendment, we have the right to lie in our ads. Because freedom of speech includes the freedom to lie. You and I all have the freedom to lie, unless we're under oath. I mean, that's the one exception to it. We have the freedom to lie, and that's an entirely appropriate thing that there be a freedom to lie. But should it be applied to corporations? Corporations under the Fourth Amendment. There was a polluting chemical company, one of the world's largest chemical companies, whistleblower within the company pointed out to the EPA that this company was releasing enormous amounts of a cancer-causing substance into the air, and it was floating downwind and contaminating local communities. The EPA came in and said, we'd like to inspect your factory. We understand you're polluting. The corporation said, well, under the Fourth Amendment, we have the right to privacy. If we have the right to privacy, we have the right to say, no, you can't come in here unless you've got a warrant, and in order to get a warrant, you have to have proof that we're doing it. And the EPA says, well, in order to get proof that you're doing it, we have to go in and take a look. And the company says, well, I guess you're out of luck. So the EPA hired a pilot in a small plane to fly over this factory, sample the air, and take pictures. And they found evidence of this. And they were all prepared to go to court to sue this company, and the company took this thing to the Supreme Court and said, EPA had no right to do that. They violated our Fourth Amendment right to privacy. And the corporation won. Since that time, several unions have brought workplace safety issues before the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, which in its original charter, just like the EPA in its original charter, had the right to do surprise inspections. And the court has since ruled in every single one of these cases. Unions, by the way, do not have rights of personhood. They can't claim these First, Fourth Amendment. We'll get to that in a second. Anyhow, the court has ruled, the Supreme Court has ruled, that corporations can keep OSHA inspectors at bay for weeks, months, years, decades, if they wish. That OSHA can only be, they can only knock down the door if they've got a warrant. And to have a warrant, they have to have proof. And to have proof, they have to get inside. And, you know, and so there's that circular logic all over again. They claim Fifth Amendment rights. There was a textile company down in Texas that was convicted of a felony crime. And then a little later on, a few years later, more evidence came out that not only had they committed that felony crime, but they had committed it in a much more horrific way than had been the original conviction. And they had committed a bunch of other crimes that were associated with it. Well, they went before the Supreme Court and said, under the Fifth Amendment, double jeopardy, we can't be tried twice for the same crime. We can't be dragged back into court for this, even though there's new evidence. And the Supreme Court, which is true for you and me, and the Supreme Court said, yep, you're right. And that company never ended up going to court. And under the 14th Amendment, the 14th Amendment was passed to free the slaves. After the Civil War, the Civil Rights Act was passed. It was literally called the Civil Rights Act, which freed the slaves, in quotes. But there were two places in the Constitution where it doesn't explicitly mention the word slavery, but by euphemism, it's structurally the Constitution was organized in such a way to allow for slavery. And it was pretty clear that this law wasn't going to be enough, that if they wanted to actually end slavery, they had to amend the Constitution. And so three constitutional amendments were put forth, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution, which guaranteed the right to vote, which guaranteed the right to access to public facilities and things, and which guaranteed the right to equal protection under the law, regardless of color. Specifically, these amendments were put there to free the slaves. Well, in the 1930s, one of the largest chain stores in America, now back then, many communities, many states, many counties, many towns had laws on the books that made it easy and comfortable for small businesses to do business in their community, in fact, encouraged it, and made it more difficult and more expensive for large predatory out-of-state corporations to come in and compete with these small companies. Very common practice. In fact, it was the norm. Everybody wanted to support and nurture small local businesses. But some of you may be old enough to remember the old Route 66 TV show, you know, where they're traveling across America on Route 66, and every town has its own unique character. Everything is different, right? You travel Route 66 now, and you see you can't distinguish one town from another. You travel around the world now, you can't distinguish one town from another. So anyhow, JCPenney took the state of Florida to court and said that it was illegal, that Florida was charging a higher license to do business within the state to an out-of-state corporation than they were to the local in-state corporations. This was 1932, and this was during the Great Depression. You know, $5 was a lot of money, but to pennies, I don't think so. They were charging local corporations $5, out-of-state corporations $25. Penney says this is unconstitutional discrimination under the 14th Amendment, which was put there to free the slaves. And the court agreed and said, oh, yep, can't discriminate against corporations. And this is the basis of why it's so hard to keep a Walmart out of a community, for example, why what are called bad boy laws have been struck down all across the United States where people have tried to do the not in my backyard thing. You know, no, we don't want this company. This corporation's been convicted of felonies. We don't want them here. This corporation is going to pollute our air. We don't want them here. According to the Supreme Court, you can't discriminate against corporations. So we have this structural situation right now that seems a little bizarre. Now, the question is, how did it get this way? Well, when I first started writing this book, I didn't actually set out to write a book about corporate personhood. I set out to write a book about Thomas Jefferson's vision of democracy. I was fascinated by democracy. I'd written an earlier book called Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, in which I had identified a number of the toxic stories in our culture that I felt were leading to the destruction of our environment and our biospheres, and the massive overpopulation of the planet, and all the meltdowns that were going on. And many of you, are familiar with that book. A few of you have mentioned it. And I was looking at, healthy alternative stories, and it seemed to me that democracy might be one. Certainly it's been imperfectly played out in the United States. But, it seemed like a good starting point. And democracy had been trained in 6,000 more or less years of what we call modern civilization, going back to Gilgamesh back in Sumeria 6,000 or 7,000 years ago. There had only been, up until the 1700s, one experiment with democracy, and that was in Athens, Greece. And it was a very strange form of democracy. Every citizen was in a lottery, and every year in the lottery they would pull names, and the names that they pulled were the people who came to the council and were the ruling body. And so every year it was somebody different, and odds were throughout your course of your lifetime you would spend at least 1 year being a legislator in Athens. And over the 200 and some odd years of democracy in Athens, they started out doing this just with the aristocracy of Athens, and they extended it all the way to the very poorest and most marginalized people toward the end of this. So this was the first experiment with democracy, and it came to a screeching end when Alexander the Great invaded Athens, and that was the end of that. And that was about 300 years before Christ. So in trying to understand what the vision of the founders of this country was for democracy, I was digging into Jefferson's letters. Thomas Jefferson wrote like 18,000 letters in his life. The guy was so prolific, in this. And I wanted to get inside his head, What was he thinking about? What was leading him to this? And I discovered a number of fascinating things. One, he had learned to read Latin, Greek, and French by the time he was 10 years old, fluently. And in one of his later letters to the president of the University of Virginia, he founded the University of Virginia. He had this vision that every American should have an opportunity to go to university for absolutely free. This was one of the big missions of his life. And the University of Virginia was his first attempt at doing this. And I found this letter from him to the president of the University of Virginia saying, if you have only two books in your library, they must be Tacitus's Agricola and Germania and The History of Great Britain by Paul de Rapine de Toras. And I'd seen at least a dozen other times, particularly in his correspondences with John Madison, where they're talking to each other about these books, and so I wanted to read them. Well, Tacitus is fairly easy to find. It's still in print, even though it was written 49 B.C. It's a lot of high school and college courses. It's required reading. Tacitus was the son-in-law of Agricola, who was the Roman general who conquered the British Islands in 49 B.C. And he dictated the story of his experience in England to Tacitus, who wrote it down. And in both of these books, what he describes is that before the eruption of kings, before the Roman conquest, that the British were self-ruled in an egalitarian tribal fashion where the women had a great deal of say and in many cases ran the program, sort of like the Iroquois nation, that decisions were made by consensus, that if everybody agreed on it, things weren't done, that there were these councils of wise elders that were held where they would discuss things for days until a consensus was achieved, that everybody played a role in the decision-making process, that Jefferson discovered, much to his amazement. Now, keep in mind, his family had been living in the United States for six generations at the time that he was born. So the time between the first settlement of North America by Europeans and the Revolutionary War is about the same amount of time as from the Civil War to today. I mean, when we think about how long ago the Civil War was, he was thinking about that's how long ago his relatives had come over to this country and or to this continent. And so it was like this epiphany for him to discover that his ancestors from England, had lived as tribal people in an egalitarian democratic society. And then I went looking for Paul Rapine de Toras's History of Great Britain. It went out of print in 1790. It hasn't been published since then. So I started an internet search for it. I spent weeks looking for this book. And I finally found a copy that was published in 1728 at St. James Church in England at an antique bookstore in London. And I spent a good chunk of the advance that I got to write this book to acquire this thing. And the reason the book went out of print is because the King of England banned it. It was written, Paul Rapin de Terrasse was a Frenchman, and it was published in France. He could not go to England. He would have been put to death because it was a history of Great Britain written by a Frenchman. And the first third of this book is about how the English people, the British people, the tribal people of England, had this democratic form of government even before Agricola. And this guy had done his homework and had interviewed all these people and had found all this evidence of the ancient... See, the Celts invaded this area 3,000 years ago. The Romans invaded 2,000 years ago. The Christians invaded 1,000 years ago. Well, in de Terrasse's book, he goes back 4, 5, 6,000 years in the history of England. And again, what he's discovering is an egalitarian society, a peaceful society, a society where men and women had equal power, a society where decisions were made by consensus. And again, Jefferson's reading this at the age of 8, 9, 10 years old, and it's just completely recalibrating his worldview. Then there's a series of letters where he talks about how his father, Peter Jefferson, was a surveyor, and he surveyed much of Virginia. He died when Jefferson was 15 years old. And Jefferson accompanied his father on many of these surveys, and his father became best friends. One of his very closest friends was a Native American chief, whose name escapes me at the moment. And Jefferson talks extensively about this guy, and he talks about he was Cherokee, but the Cherokee were putting together an alignment with the Iroquois at this time to, you know, against the British. And Jefferson talks about how he went to a meeting where this fellow was saying goodbye to his people because he was about to get on a ship, one of the ships owned by the East India Company, and sail across the sea to England to try and negotiate with the king to stop the slaughter of the Native Americans. And Jefferson talks about the nature of the Iroquois Confederacy. And of course, you know, 30-some-odd members of the Iroquois Confederacy were invited by Jefferson and Madison and Franklin to sleep and live in the second floor of Liberty Hall in Philadelphia while the Constitution was being written. And every day, these guys were down there saying, well, this is how we do it, and this is how, you know, some of the major advisors. In my research about Jefferson and what I was discovering about him, Jefferson identified three oppressors of humans. We're familiar in general with two of them. The first oppressor that he identified was the religious oppression of humans. In fact, Jefferson rewrote the New Testament to take out all the miracles that Jesus did, turn him into a normal person, to make it the story of a guy who was preaching democracy. It's called the Jefferson Bible. And he was convinced that one of the historic oppressors had been popes, you know, the Crusades, the Dark Ages, medieval times, you know, that religion was one of the oppressors. And he was absolutely and firmly convinced that they had to put into place a wall, a barrier, that would keep government, which could theoretically, even the new government that they were creating, which could theoretically live forever, from ever being taken over by a church or by the religious. And that's the First Amendment, which doesn't just say we have freedom of religion. It says Congress shall enact no laws regarding the establishment of a religion. It's just an absolute wall between church and state. The second oppressor that Jefferson identified was the historic kings, the warlords, the kings and queens, but usually it was men who started it. They would rise up and you know, the biggest army, the nastiest people, the ones most willing to kill, ended up in power. And the Battle of Hastings in 1099 was the turning point, according to Paul Rapin de Terrasse, when the final tribal groups in England fell under the domination of what is now the royal family of England. So anyhow, he identified these two oppressors, and the second oppressor, the kingly oppressions, they dealt with very explicitly in the Declaration of Independence. You know, we're simply not going to have any more of this anymore, thank you very much. You know, government shall not be a source of oppression. And in fact, in the Declaration of Independence, they say it's not only the right of people to change their government if it ever becomes oppressive, it's their duty. So those were the first of the two oppressors. The third oppressor, however, that Jefferson identified is not well known to most people because most people haven't read 4,000 of his letters. And somehow this stuff doesn't make its way into our history books. When Madison was try to shepherd the Constitution through and get it ratified. Jefferson was the envoy to France, and he was living in France, and he and Madison were working out the Bill of Rights in correspondence. And so there's all these letters back and forth between these two men. And Jefferson said he was going to tell the Virginia delegation to vote against the Constitution unless there was a Bill of Rights attached to it. And Madison was agitating for this, and it was a very popular notion, and of course it ended up being passed. And Jefferson had 12 things that he wanted in the Bill of Rights. This is just a little bit of a digression, but it's just fascinating, so I'll lay it on you. One of them was that there would be, in the Bill of Rights, in the Constitution, it would say that the United States could have a permanent navy to protect its borders, but could not have a standing army. He wanted a system just like Switzerland has, where every able-bodied citizen has a gun in their home and is a member of a local militia. And if the nation goes to war, then the militia emerges and fights back the aggressors. And after the war, the militia vanishes again and goes back to peace. Because he knew that nations that had standing armies historically had had the problem of the armies acquiring so much power that they ended up taking over government and driving the decisions of government. And he didn't want that to happen. And there's a reason why Hitler stopped at the border of Switzerland, because what I just described to you is the Swiss system. There is no Swiss army, but every citizen in Switzerland is required to have a gun in their home, and every citizen of Switzerland is a member of a militia. So the partner to this 11th Amendment that Jefferson was proposing at the time that they were proposing these was the Second Amendment. And now, you know, the Second Amendment, the Gun Rights Amendment, everybody says, oh, well, what the founders meant, this is like the NRA position, what the founders meant is if the government ever becomes oppressive, you know, like they talk about in the Declaration of Independence, we need to have guns so that we can fight them back. Well, that doesn't make any sense. If that was true, then we should also be able to have nuclear weapons, right? We should also, you know, it doesn't make any sense. And the Second Amendment doesn't say, you know, citizens can have cannons, right? Which was, you know, part of the armament back then. You know, instead, the Second Amendment says, in order to have a well-regulated militia, that's the first part of the Second Amendment. Remember? That's how it starts out. The government shall not infringe upon the right of individuals to own guns or weapons or I don't remember the exact language, but these two amendments were supposed to go like this. The assumption was there's no standing army. If there's no standing army, then every citizen has to be a potential member of an army if we ever get invaded. So we're going to pass these two amendments that will work like this together and make that happen. Well, the no standing army one didn't get passed. Jefferson tried to do it. When he became president, there were 360,000 men in the United States Army, and by the time he left office, there were 3,000. He was closing military bases left and right. The problem was he didn't build up the Navy at the same time, and you know, so history blames him for the War of 1812, you know, that he weakened our army. I would say that it's nowhere near that simple, but in any case. So that was one of the two amendments. The 12th Amendment that Jefferson proposed, and there's a whole series of letters that he proposed about this, and they're reprinted in this book, was an absolute ban on commercial monopolies. An absolute ban on commercial monopolies. Now, what that meant was corporations can't own stock in other corporations. A corporation can be incorporated for a single purpose and can only do that one thing. A corporation can operate in one area, but if it wants to operate in another area, there has to be another corporation. A corporation has to be locally owned and controlled. And this was consistent with the thinking of the founders. The word corporation does not exist in the Constitution of the United States, and the reason it doesn't exist is because they very clearly, and we'll get to this in just a second with the East India Company, the Boston Tea Party, they understood that corporations were potential sources of oppression, and they wanted them to be locally controlled. So local communities had the power to hold them. So then as I'm reading Jefferson's stuff, I'm also coming across these references to the rebellion against the company. You know, references to the rebellion against the company that led to the Revolutionary War. And, you know, that raised my curiosity. And so I started looking around, and I figured out by implication that the rebellion against the company that he was talking about was the Boston Tea Party. And I started looking for histories of the Boston Tea Party, and you won't find any very good histories of the Boston Tea Party because there were roughly 150 people who participated in the Boston Tea Party, and they all swore an oath of secrecy for their lives. You know, until they died, they would never reveal the names of anybody else who participated. And so to this day, the only person that we know for sure who participated was Sam Adams, because he was bragging about it way back when. Well, again, looking through this stuff, I found in an antique bookstore out in San Francisco a book published in 1828 that was a set of memoirs that were written in the 1790s by a man named George Robert Twelve Tree Hughes, George R.T. Hughes. And it was called, as I recall, a retrospective of the little band of men who drowned the tea in the Boston Harbor. And in fact, in this book, it's the first time the phrase Tea Party was used, because they didn't refer to it back then as the Tea Party. They referred to it as the Rebellion. And the phrase Tea Party didn't come into common usage until the 1820s. And this book was written by one of the people who was actually there at the Boston Tea Party. It's the only, as far as I can tell, it's the only first-person account that exists. And again, it's out of print. It's been out of print since 1828. Reading through this book, I discovered that what I had been taught in high school civics, that, you know, the Intolerable Acts, you know, the Townsend Acts, the Stamp Act, you know, all these attempts by England to raise revenue, yeah, there was all that stuff going on, and people were upset about that, and they were successful in getting Britain to withdraw those things. But then there was the Tea Act, of 1773, when, as I recall from civics class, they raised the tax on tea, and everybody in the colonies drank tea. We were importing over 1,000,000 pounds a month of tea, and tea was such a huge commodity. It was the drug of choice of the colonists, along with alcohol, you know, that, you know, this was just an absolutely intolerable thing, and so they revolted by throwing the tea in the harbor with the Boston Tea Party. Well, it turns out, reading this book by Hughes, he says, the East India Company, through political corruption and bribery, had gone to the British Parliament. They had given stock to members of the British Parliament, and of course it had been incorporated by the Queen, and had been instrumental in forming many of the original states in the United States, and owned much of the United States at this point, that the British East India Company had gotten past the Tea Act of 1773, which eliminated the tax on tea. It wasn't a raise on the tax on tea. It was an elimination of the tax on tea. Furthermore, they got a multi-million dollar tax rebate from the British government on the tea that they had in inventory that was destined for North America, so that they could sell it below the going price that even the local entrepreneurs and smugglers were selling it for. This was going to put out of business literally thousands of small tea shops. I mean, having a tea shop was like one of the major businesses, like Starbucks today. It was one of the major businesses in colonial England, in colonial America. And most of these, you know, these small entrepreneurial ventures were buying their tea from small companies. There were all these small ships that were coming back and forth from Holland, from England. There were many small tea vendors in England who were also very upset about this. And so what was happening was this one giant transnational corporation had seized control of the British Parliament, had gotten legislation passed favorable to them, tax legislation, which allowed them to completely overwhelm and put out of business many, if not most, of the smaller entrepreneurs in America, and in fact to declare illegal the importation of tea into the United States from certain areas by private vessels. They called them privateers, and put them under the Pirate Act, which meant that anybody who was bringing that tea in could be put to death. You know, this wasn't about, I mean, it was taxation without representation, but it was the limitation of taxation. It was the elimination of the tax, you know. And so what they did was they went down, these 150 people, they went down and they tossed the tea in the harbor. And they did it silently, and they did it respectfully. But it was a $1 million act of vandalism against the world's largest transnational corporation. This was the first WTO Seattle And this was the thing that inspired Jefferson a year later to write the summary view of the British rights of British America in 1774, when he was in the Virginia House of Burgesses, much of which became the language of the Declaration of Independence in 1776. So the founders, you know, Jefferson's 11th and 12th Amendments didn't get passed. The Federalists, John Adams and Alexander Hamilton and John Jay, in particular, those three men, you know, fought back the idea. They wanted to have a standing army, and I believe that they wanted the best for this country, too. I don't think this is about good people and bad people. I think that it's about two different visions of how best to create a nation. And the Federalists wanted there to be a nation that was going to be an industrial powerhouse with great military strength. And Jefferson wanted there to be a nation that was going to be an entrepreneurial country with great diversity and that only became military in the event of attack, and that wasn't a world power like England. whereas Alexander Hamilton wrote, when they were writing the Constitution, wrote at one point in one of the newspapers that he felt that monarchy was the best and most long-lived and most likely to survive form of government that there was. So there were these two different points of view, but Jefferson didn't get his way. So what happened was that throughout the early 19th century, the states stepped in where Jefferson failed. And virtually every state in the Union had laws on the books which made it a crime for a corporation to participate in the political process, for a corporation to act in a monopolistic fashion, that corporations couldn't own stock in other corporations, that corporations had to be incorporated for 10, 20, or 30 years, and at the end of that time they ceased to exist. If they wanted to continue doing business, they had to start all over again. That every year the Attorney General of the state had to examine the corporation, and if the corporation wasn't conducting itself in a way that was useful to the citizens of the state, the corporate charter was terminated. That the first thing that every corporate charter had to say was that this corporation is created to further the good and welfare of the people of the state in which it's incorporated. And then the second thing is, and we're going to make widgets and make money at it. And that if those two things weren't being accomplished, the corporation was ended. And they were very, very tightly constrained. Their books had to be fully open and available to the government, to we the people at all times, because we the people authorized their existence. That it was a felony for an officer of a corporation, a personal felony for an officer of a corporation to meet with a politician and discuss the business of the corporation. It was a felony for an officer of a corporation to give money to a politician on behalf of the corporation. They could go to jail for 5 years and face huge fines. Again, the laws are quoted in here. And these laws were just, you know, right across the country. Everybody understood. Corporations need to be, you know, held in check. They need to be constrained. Again, there's these great quotes from James Madison and Monroe and Buchanan and Polk, and I mean all these presidents, one after another, are all saying that the power of corporations is something to be guarded against repeatedly, over and over and over, every single president all through the early years. Well, then the railroads started rising. In 1830, the steam engine, more or less, within a few years of 1830, the steam engine was invented in England. In the early 1830s, the first railroad was incorporated in America, the Boston, Ohio, the Baltimore and Ohio, the B&O Railroad in Baltimore. And they started laying track, and they built the first railroad steam engine, the Spirit of Charleston, it was called. And between 1830 and the time of the Civil War, the railroads went from nothing to being the largest and most powerful corporations in the United States, perhaps in the world. They were absolutely massive. It was sort of like Microsoft, you know, it was like the computer industry. I mean, it came out of nowhere and suddenly, boom, it was huge. And the Civil War was a huge boon to the railroads. They just made an absolute fortune during the Civil War, you know, moving material around and troops and everything, and the government was just throwing money at them, giving them money, giving them land. Hundreds of millions of acres of land were given to them to build track bed as fast as they could so that they could get troops out for the war. And Lincoln had some very real concerns about this. There's a letter that he wrote to a friend of his that's in the book here expressing his concern that he trembles for the future of our democracy because corporations have been enthroned as a consequence of this war. And then, of course, after the Civil War, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were passed to free the slaves. This was in the 1860s. And starting in the 1870s, the railroads said, you know, we really don't like the way these local communities are regulating. You know, sort of like a well-known software corporation really recently tried to say to the government, you know, we don't like being regulated. Maybe the metaphor isn't exact, so I shouldn't use it. But in any case, the railroad started saying, you know, we don't think that we should be regulated like this. We should be free of regulation. Now, in most places, the railroads were monopolies. They would meet in big cities, of course, but most communities were just served by one railroad. And the railroads were saying, listen, under the 14th Amendment, we're being discriminated against. In this county, they're saying that we can only charge $10 a mile or 10 cents a mile to carry people. And in this county, they're saying it's 12 cents a mile. In this county, they're taxing us at 11 cents an acre on our land. In this county, they're taxing us 3 cents an acre on this land. That's not equal protection under the law that the 14th Amendment guarantees all persons. Well, historically, corporations had to have some sort of status at law. They were called artificial persons, so that they could go to court, they could own property, they could pay taxes, and humans were referred to as natural persons. Well, the 14th Amendment, unfortunately, doesn't make the distinction. It starts out by saying, all persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens of the United States. So it's clearly talking about people. And then it says, no person shall be denied equal protection under the law. Well, the railroads pointed to that. They said it says no person. And we're a person. We're an artificial person, but we're a person. So we should have rights under the Bill of Rights. And the court said no. No, forget it. Not a chance. And the railroad kept taking cases. 1784 was the peak year. I think they had four cases before the court that year. And they kept arguing, we are persons. And finally, there was this one case in 1886, Santa Clara County had versus the Southern Pacific Railroad. For 6 years, Southern Pacific Railroad had refused to pay their taxes to Santa Clara County, claiming, number one, that they were being taxed on fence posts that were assessed by the county assessor, when in fact the state assessor was the one who had the legal authority to determine the value of the fence posts. And number two, that the taxes in Santa Clara County were different than the taxes in San Mateo County, and that was unconstitutional under the 14th Amendment, and therefore they didn't have to pay taxes at all. And this case went before the Supreme Court. And if you talk to lawyers, anybody who's graduated from law school in the United States in the last 50 years, which includes most of our legislators who are attorneys, if you talk to attorneys, they will tell you that they learned in law school that in that 1886 case of Santa Clara County versus the Southern Pacific Railroad, that the Supreme Court, in fact, ruled that corporations are persons under the 14th Amendment and entitled to civil rights, entitled to human rights, access to the Bill of Rights. Well, I was curious about this, and I wanted to read the decision. And I didn't know, I talked to a number of people about it, and I'd read in a whole bunch of books in 1886, corporations got the rights of persons. But I didn't know anybody who'd read the decision. So I live in Montpelier, Vermont, which is this, a little town of 9,000 people. It's the smallest state capital in the United States, the only one with no McDonald's. Periodically they sue us, and we sue back, and, we've been holding them at bay for decades now. So I went over to the Supreme Court building, and they got a great library there, and found the head librarian, a guy named Paul Donovan. And I said, Paul, can you find me this case? And he said, yeah, I think I've got the original book, And we go back into these dusty old stacks, and pulls out an 1889 published copy of U.S. Reports, bound in leather and, the dust flying off it. Nobody's looked at this thing in 100 years, And he pulls it out, and he sets it on the table, and he flips through it, and there's the case right there. And I had enough coffee in me that I could pay attention for probably a half hour or an hour. And so I sat down and I read the case. And when you read the case, the Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, you discover that the court ruled that, yes, in fact, the state assessors should have assessed the fence posts, not the county assessors. Therefore, the case is dismissed. And that's it. And in fact, they make mention of the fact that the railroads had argued that there were constitutional dimensions to the case, that being personhood, and that the court passed on ruling on that subject because it was unnecessary, because it could be decided based on the fence posts. So I go get Paul, and I say, Paul, this doesn't make sense. This isn't what everybody tells me. This isn't what I'm reading in all these books. This isn't what the lawyers go. And he says, well, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know. And he says, here, look at the fine print at the very front. Maybe that'll give you some enlightenment. And there's like this couple of paragraphs of very small print in the front of the case, which is not the case. But it's a commentary on the case called a headnote, which kind of summarizes what the case is about. And it was written by the court reporter, a man by the name of John Chandler Bancroft Davis, J.C. Bancroft Davis, in 1886. And the first sentence of the headnote says, corporations are persons under the 14th Amendment entitled to equal rights under the law. And I looked at that and I said, Paul, that's not what the ruling says. And he said, well, you're going to have to ask a lawyer about that. So I said, can you make copies? He said, sure, we got a copy machine right here. He made a bunch of copies. I paid my 70 cents, went down the street and around the corner to the office of Jim Ritvo, who's an old friend of mine who's a lawyer who graduated from law school and knows law. I mean, I'm an old reporter. I was a reporter for 7 years. I know how to dig stories out. I know how to, but I'm not a lawyer. And so I laid this stuff out on Jim's desk, and I said, Jim, look at this. And I had highlighted the spots, where the court said, no, we didn't decide that. And I had highlighted Davis's thing. And I said, Jim, the case and the commentary on the case say opposite things. And Jim looked at it, and he said, holy cow. But actually, it was a little more expletive than that, And I said, what is this? And he said, it's a mistake. I said, a mistake? We have based law in the United States for 120 years on a mistake? And he said, well, sometimes these things happen. He said, He said, one of the things they teach you at law school is don't just read the head notes because they're not always accurate. And I said, but, you know, but companies are claiming that they have the First Amendment right to talk to politicians, and they struck down thousands of laws across the United States that kept corporations out of politics based on this case. Companies are claiming that they have the Fourth Amendment right to privacy, that they can hide what they know about asbestos and tobacco from the public and from the government because they have the right to privacy based on this case. The corporations are claiming that they don't have to testify against themselves. They have a right against self-incrimination based on this case. Corporations are claiming that the giant predatory companies can come into communities and eat them alive and nobody can stop them based on this case. And he's like, you know, don't get hysterical, Tom. And I said, well, what is it? And he said, I don't know, but you need to talk to somebody who knows constitutional law. He said, I'm not a constitutional scholar. I defend criminals or whatever he does. You know, people who've been charged with crimes. He's a criminal defense lawyer. He said, why don't you call Deb Markowitz? Well, another one of the charming things about living in Vermont, Deb Markowitz is the Secretary of State for Vermont. And so I look her phone number up in the phone book, and I dial it, and hello, this is Deb Markowitz. So cool. And I said, Deb, I don't think you know who I am, but I'm writing this book, and I just came across this thing in Santa Clara County versus Union Pacific Railroad, or the Southern Pacific Railroad. And she said, oh, the one that gave a corporate personhood case. And, right, she'd been to law school. And I said, yeah, that case. I said, did you ever read the decision? And she said, no, I just learned about it in law school. And I said, well, let me read you a couple sentences. And I read her the stuff. And her reaction was kind of similar to Jim's, you know. It's like, whoa. And I said, you know, if all of this law for 120 years has been based on a lie, what does that mean? Does that mean that, like, we could just, like, throw it out tomorrow? And she said, well, to the best of my knowledge, there have been about 30 or 35 Supreme Court cases since then that have referred to that case. And she said the first time a case refers to another case, even if they refer to it incorrectly, that second case then becomes the legal precedent. So it is the law, even though it's based on a lie. So then I started wondering, who the hell is John Chandler Bancroft Davis? Who is this guy who wrote this in the head notes? And who... So I started looking him up. I got the family genealogy that was published in 1904, you know, I think the only picture in existence of him. I put it on our website. Here's the real criminal, right? Anyhow, he was the son of the former governor of Massachusetts. He was the U.S. envoy to Germany. He had been the assistant of Secretary of State in the Ulysses S. Grant administration and resigned in the midst of the railroad bribery scandals. Probably most of you don't remember this, but the U.S. Grant, the Republican Party was so offended by him, that, if you can imagine this, that they refused to nominate him for a third term because so many of the people in his administration had been bribed by the railroads and outed or convicted or had to leave office as a consequence of it. It was considered one of the most corrupt administrations in history to this day. Although, you know, they've got some serious competition. And interestingly, J.C. Bancroft Davis had been the president of the board of directors of the Newburgh, New York Railroad. He was a railroad president. And then I looked at Morrison Remick Waite, the chief justice of the Supreme Court, the guy who he claimed had said this in his head note. And, of course, back then it took about 3 years for a book to get published, especially a big, thick law book with Supreme Court decisions. They had to be transcribed, then they had to be typeset by hand, and they had to be printed on these presses and bound, and they had to cut the leather for the, you know, all this stuff. And the book was published 3 years after the case in 1889. Well, in 1887, Waite was so sick he was in court only a few days, and in the spring of 1888 he was dead. He probably never even knew what Davis said he'd said, which I find, you know, mind-boggling. So the last time anybody really talked about this in the United States was Franklin Roosevelt. This became a big issue during the Great Depression when people were trying to figure out how the robber barons get away with what they got away with. And James and Mary Beard published a book called A History of America, and they talk about this at some length. And this was fairly common knowledge among my grandparents' generation. But my parents don't know about it, and I didn't know about it. I didn't learn about it. This idea of corporate personhood having happened by virtue of a trick, that the 14th Amendment was missing the word natural before the word person. Now, here's an interesting little segue in terms of time. 1886, corporations get personhood. Sort of. But according to the law schools and everybody, you know, in the Supreme Court, 1886, corporations get personhood. 6 years later, 1872, in Bradwell versus Illinois, a woman by the name of Bradwell, I think it was Mary Bradwell, was an attorney in Chicago, and she wanted to practice law, and a judge had said that she couldn't practice in his courtroom because she was a woman, and it went to the Supreme Court. It was actually much more complicated than that, but basically it was our women persons also. So women came before the Supreme Court in 1872 and said, we'd like to be people. And in the 1873 Bradwell versus Illinois decision, I'm quoting, the Supreme Court ruled that women were not entitled to the full protection of persons under the 14th Amendment. Justice Bradley wrote the court's concurring opinion, which minced no words, quote, the family institution is repugnant to the idea of a woman adopting a distinct and independent career from that of her husband. So firmly fixed was the sentiment in the founders of the common law that it became a maxim of that system of jurisprudence that a woman has no legal existence separate from her husband, according to the Supreme Court in 1872. Well, then, 10 years after that, a fellow by the name of Plessy, who was the son of a freed slave, hopped on a railroad car, walked into the whites-only compartment, got thrown off, got on, got thrown off, got on, got arrested by a man named Ferguson who worked for the railroad, and this got dragged all the way up to the Supreme Court. And so the descendants of the slaves for whom the 14th Amendment was passed were standing before the Supreme Court saying, can we be persons? And in the Plessy versus Ferguson case, court reporter J.C. Bancroft Davis, a name you all know and love now, wrote the head notes in which he said, quote, being a passenger between the two stations within the state of Louisiana was assigned by the officers of the railroad company the coach used for the race to which he belonged, but he insisted upon going to a coach used by a race to which he did not belong. And then he quotes the 14th Amendment. And then he says, the object of the amendment was undoubtedly to enforce the absolute equality of the two races before the law, but the nature of things, it could not have been intended to abolish distinctions based upon color, or to enforce social as distinguished from political equality, or a commingling of the two races upon terms unsatisfactory to either. In other words, the court said, no, people who are of anything other than European Caucasian ancestry, they're not persons either. This also was applied to the Chinese, the Orientals who were working on the railroads. So corporations were persons, but women were not, and freed slaves were not. Which brings us to the question, what can we do about this? You know, what's happened since then? One of the really interesting things is that the Supreme Court, you know, the way that we're taught about the Supreme Court in civics class is that it's kind of like this monolithic institution that interprets the Constitution and says, this is truth, and that's the end of the discussion, and that's the way it'll always be. The fact of the matter is, though, that the court is a political and social institution as much as anything else in government is, and it reflects the times. And in the Plessy versus Ferguson case in 1896, the court made a horrible mistake. And in Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, the court was presented with an opportunity to correct that mistake, and they took that opportunity and they fixed that mistake to the extent that the court could. I mean, subsequent legislation was necessary, but it was the beginning of the enfranchisement of large groups of people beyond just whites. Similarly, in 1873, in the Bradwell versus Illinois case, the court had said women are not persons. But in 1973 or 74, in Roe v. Wade, women came before the court and said, we would like to have the right to privacy under the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. We would like to be considered persons. And the court, reflecting the contemporary worldview, said, yeah, that makes sense. And they reversed the Bradwell case. Now, we still haven't passed the Equal Rights Amendment. We're still not there. I mean, we're still not there with equality between the races. I mean, none of this stuff is completely done, but we've been, it appears, moving in the right direction, and hopefully we'll move a lot farther in the right direction. So what has happened now is 10 communities in the state of Pennsylvania, with the help of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, have passed ordinances saying that corporations cannot own farms to keep out big factory farms. In order to do this, you have to deny that a corporation is a person. This is a denial of corporate personhood. These cases will end up before the Supreme Court. They're being fought by the giant agribiz corporations. I took some other of the advance. I didn't end up with a whole lot left over after I was paid for this book. Took some of the other of the advance money for this book and hired CELDEF, or gave them a grant, to have one of their lawyers, a fellow by the name of Dan Brennan, a brilliant attorney, go through the law books of every single state in the United States and customize an ordinance which says corporations are not persons in our community, which could be passed by a township, a county, a city, an unincorporated township, any kind of legal governmental body within a state, and customize them for all 50 states. And it's like the last 20 pages or so of the book. And we put that up on the website, unequalprotection.com, where you can just click on your state and download it for free and just fill in the blanks, and you have an instant, you know, you get enough signatures to put it on a ballot, and boom, you're off and running. Okay. And then Dan said, after he had done that, he said, you know, in reading the constitutions, I noticed that after 1886, most of the states rewrote their constitutions to give corporations personhood. We got to fix that too. And he went through and compiled proposed constitutional amendments, state by state, for every one of the 50 states. And a suggested federal constitutional amendment, which would insert the word natural before the word person in the 14th Amendment. And those also are in the book, and they're also on the website, you know, where you can just get it. You know, you don't even need to buy the book. This is like the legal way of going about this. Now, there's also, you know, legal stuff generally isn't successful until there's first a social consensus. If the Roe v. Wade case had gone before the Supreme Court in the 1940s, odds are it wouldn't have won. But, you know, birth control pills came along in the 1960s. There was a sexual revolution. There was women's lib movement. There was all this stuff that happened. And the court was reflecting the widespread knowledge that was out there. If there was widespread knowledge out there that corporations are not persons, that the human rights defined in the Bill of Rights, the first through the 15th Amendments of the Constitution, have been stolen by corporations, and that the theft was perpetrated by a man who was not even a member of the court, but an employee of the court, and that this has never been written into law, no legislature has ever voted on this, no Supreme Court decision has ever been, it's never been argued before the court where the court made a ruling about it, and no president has ever declared it. In fact, there's a long history of presidents saying no corporations should not be persons, and those quotes are all in here in the book. If we can wake enough people up to this fact, then the probability of when one of those Pennsylvania cases, there's one going up in North Dakota, the Green Party in Arizona is talking about in 2006 putting on the ballot a constitutional amendment to the state of Arizona denying corporate personhood, then those kinds of things may have a chance to win. But right now, you talk to the average person about corporate personhood, they're going, huh? They don't realize that this is the pivot point. This is the linchpin. This is the thing that's holding it all together. You pull out corporate personhood, and suddenly you can have meaningful campaign finance reform. I mean, we've been reduced to the point now where with McCain-Feingold, they don't regulate corporations in that law because you can't. They're persons. They regulate politicians. That doesn't make any sense. We need to be regulating the corporations. The corporations are hiding their crimes. I mean, you pull out corporate personhood and the whole thing becomes available to we the people. We the people can take back democracy. Now, it's not a silver bullet. There's going to be a lot of work after that case. Just like passing the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment didn't literally end slavery, and it certainly didn't end apartheid. And just like the Brown v. Board of Education wasn't, and Roe v. Wade, I mean, you know, but these are major milestones along the way. And ending corporate personhood is a huge, pivotal, critical, major milestone that we need to confront. So in order to raise consciousness, there's another option that I encourage you to pursue, which the city of Point Arena, California, down in Mendocino County, did 2 years ago, where they passed a resolution. Now, see, the townships in Pennsylvania are being sued. That's expensive. Some townships don't have the money to be sued. Point Arena is a town of 600 people. They didn't want to be sued, so they passed a resolution saying, in our township, we don't believe corporations are persons. We're not going to do anything about it, but we want everybody to know this is how we think. And it was a huge educational process. A huge awakening happened in Mendocino County as a consequence of Point Arena passing that resolution. So, frankly, I would encourage you to start with a resolution that corporations are not persons, because then you're not actually fighting a legal battle. You're simply raising consciousness. And then when you've got enough people woken up to this fact, then you go after the resolutions and the constitutional amendments. That's the order in which I would suggest. And I think once we do this and we can constrain some of these huge multinational corporations that have become the tails that wag the dogs of government, that have seized control of our country, then there can be a new entrepreneurial boom in America. Then democracy can re-emerge in an even more democratic form than we've ever had before. And that Lincoln's quote, which I frankly at this moment think is very much at risk, may actually end up becoming true, that a nation of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth. In 1773, Thomas Paine stood before the City Hall in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and read the first page of the first newsletter that he had published in America. It was called The Crisis. He later changed the name of the newsletter to Common Sense. And that first paragraph said, and he probably had 30, 40 people standing there as he was reading this, and he said, "These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will now, no doubt, shrink from the service of their country. But tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. We have a new tyranny in America. It's the tyranny that Thomas Jefferson warned about, that he desperately tried to get a constitutional amendment passed to prevent, the tyranny of what he called commercial monopolies and that we now call corporate personhood, the tyranny of entire governments being taken over by corporations, the tyranny of politicians living in terror of corporations, of a media being seized by corporations because the government sold off the commons of the airwaves in order to pay for Star Wars, which was the consequence of corporations using their First Amendment rights to lobby the court, you know, and just on and on it goes. Right, we are facing this new tyranny in America, and it's time to put an end to it. It's time to stop it, and to stop it. And this is, in my opinion, this is the main tool that we can use to stop it dead in its tracks and begin and return our nation to we the people. Thank you.